Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished watching Lasse Hallström's 1985 film, My Life as a Dog. And what a great movie it was.
Mm.
Yes.
Yes, I did notes, which is rare.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've had to crack open a notepad to write down some stuff, but
A good sign.
Yeah, you'd never seen this film before.
That's right.
Yeah. And I saw this film, I'm estimating, 13 years ago, so I've forgotten most of it.
Yeah, like, at that point, do you remember anything from it, or it's just...
Bits and pieces.
Yeah, okay.
Like, little bit, I remember, yeah, little odds and ends, so, yeah. Mm. But the film as a whole, I didn't really retain much, so... Mm. But, yeah, I suppose, Lasse Hallström, like, before we get into the film itself, like, Lasse Hallström, are you familiar much with his work?
I've seen What's Eating Gilbert Grape, but that would have been about 13 years ago.
Yeah, okay. He's a filmmaker I thoroughly enjoy. I think when I first watched this movie about 12, 13 years ago, whenever it was, I went on a bit of a Lasse Hallström kick, because What's Eating Gilbert Grape is incredible. I really enjoy the Cider House Rules. This was probably around about the time that Chocolat or Casanova came out, so kind of went...
I don't know if I've seen them. What's Chocolat about? Chocolat.
Chocolat?
Chocolat.
It's about a woman who opens a chocolatier.
Okay, no, I haven't seen that.
And Juliette Binoche. It's really great. But Cider House Rules, you'd probably know. It's a classic John Irving novel about kids growing up in an orphanage. Michael Caine plays the guy who runs the orphanage. Won an Academy Award. It's beautiful.
Okay, yeah, I feel like these are the films that... So back when I was younger, back when Video Easy and Blockbuster were still a thing...
Yep.
I would go and rent for $10, you can get 10 weeklies.
Yes. Shit, that's a lot of movies.
Yeah, so I'd do that every single week. For ages, and I was just going through probably IMDb at that stage. This is like really early stage.
Yeah, this is like late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I was going, what's winning awards? And let's go back to the 60s and, you know, whatever. I think at that stage I wasn't really into black and white until now that I'm doing the Criterion stuff, it's fine.
Yeah.
But I would go through and try and find all of the
quote unquote
best films ever. And I thought these are the kinds of films that I should have found.
But that being said, these are the kind of films you wouldn't necessarily... Like, My Life as a Dog, you wouldn't find in an Australian blockbuster in, you know, 2002.
Not, that's like, right, not was, this one.
Yeah.
But I did find What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Yeah, I honestly don't know if this ever came out on DVD in Australia, this film.
Yeah, it's a smallie, you know, a small one.
Mm. But sorry, you said you have seen What's Eating Gilbert Grape. And...
Yeah, but then I would have thought, I was finding stuff, like, I'd never seen Unforgiven.
Okay,
until,
yeah,
like, ages, and I'd found that, popped up in at Video Easy, and you kind of scrolling through the massive catalogues that they have, and I would have thought that Cider House Rules would have popped up, and I would have gone, like, I should watch that.
I have a feeling Cider House Rules is, like, 99, maybe? So it's around the same time as, like, American Beauty and stuff was coming out.
Oh, fucking hell. Well, I should have even seen that at cinemas. I don't know why I didn't see that then.
It's kind of slipped under the radar, I guess.
Yeah.
It was kind of, I think maybe post... It was right around the time Tobey Maguire was becoming Spider-Man, so it might have been a bit of backlash around... And it's young Charlize Theron and Kieran. It's got Kieran Culkin, for fuck's sake. That guy's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that guy.
Yeah.
But enough about Lasse Hallström films in general. We should jump into this week's film, My Life as a Dog. Do you want to do plot synopsis on this one?
All right, I'll give it a shot. This film follows a young boy, Ingmar, who has a sick mother, and he and his brother have been forced to live away from home to give her a chance to recuperate, to battle her sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes... the brother goes off somewhere.
He goes to stay with his grandmother.
Okay. Yeah. And young Ingmar, the youngest brother, goes to his uncle's place, and we follow him through a series of pleasantries and troubles as he deals with the problems of living away from his mum.
Yeah.
And being disconnected from, like a strong connection with somebody that would support him.
Yeah, we're presented a series of almost vignettes of experience of a small, kind of odd character who is alienated by a society that is welcoming of him, I guess. Yes. Which
thanks for leading up my synopsis.
Yeah, well, that's... that's what's interesting. That is a kind of theme that runs through the majority of Lasse Hallström's films, is this idea of having a kind of weird or a little bit left-of-center protagonist who is put into an environment where he is where they are the outsider, where they then have to learn and adapt to that society or learn to interact with it.
Or just rely on people around them to care for them. I mean, like, what's eating Gilbert Grape is exactly like that.
Yeah, yeah. They are the oddball family in the town, and it's about them kind of interacting in there. Like, not much happens really in Gilbert Grape, similar to this film. Like, not much happens, but so much happens. It's just these little sweet vignettes of a life of this kid, which is like, yeah.
Well, I actually think it's, this film really reminded me of some Studio Ghibli films.
Okay, any in particular?
Basically, the ones by, is it Isao Yakut?
Grave of the Fireflies, gentlemen.
Yeah, what's that guy name? I wrote him down.
Isao
Takahata.
Yeah.
And he's everyone knows Miyazaki and he does the fantasy stuff.
Yes.
But then this guy does the more kind of quiet... They're an interesting...
Family-driven pieces.
Yeah, they're an interesting one because you could do live action for a lot of them, but there's these... It just gives, like, a lovely warmth when he does the illustrations.
Mm.
And I was getting a strong sense that this could have been an animation.
Okay.
The music is really lovely piano stuff that's kind of got that lighthearted approach, similar to, you know, a Ghibli...
Yeah.
Soundtrack. And then just in general, you're always just focusing on small little moments through a kid's perspective, which is also very prevalent in a lot of these Ghibli works.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously the one... I was honestly expecting you to say Totoro in the sense of... It draws a lot of similarities, this film, in the sense of it's two kids who have... separated from their mother who is sick and dying in a hospital and, you know, end up going on these interesting little adventures.
Mm. No, so. That's perfect, exactly.
Mm.
But I think what's really remarkable about this film is, same with the Ghibli stuff, is that it lets these lovely little nuanced moments of movement just sit on in the camera shot between just a couple of kids. There's like there's sequences where Ingmar is with that young... This is towards the start of the film, that young blonde girl.
Yeah, yeah.
In that pipeline.
Yes, with the train going over.
Yeah, and there's some just really lovely shots of her feet, no shoes on, sticking out of the pipe, and you can't see her, but they're talking, and she's kind of, like, fiddling her toes.
Yeah, okay, so you're meaning movement of character, not necessarily movement of camera.
No, definitely camera. Yeah, definitely a character.
Yeah.
It's like an animation where you typically don't have much movement of the camera. It's just all the characters kind of have these small, subtle... bodily movements that give you a story about them.
Yeah.
And animators are obsessed with that kind of stuff.
Yes, because their camera's primarily locked off and they have to...
And I mean, like, you want to explain as much as you can about a person through how they move their body.
Mm.
And I found that this film is doing a lot of the same thing, where it's letting... it's letting just the actors play around with their... with their movement, in such a way that it just becomes such a charming, lovely experience.
Yeah, it's a really visually driven film in that sense. In terms of, there's not much. There's a lot going on in terms of the script. In that, Ingmar is a very intelligent and switched on weirdo for, you know, being a 12-year-old. He's very aware, kind of almost hyper aware of his situation and being able to extrapolate, kind of. Instances for in history and things for him to latch onto, like mainly Laika the dog, which we'll get to later.
Yeah,
I feel.
Yes, that's a very but
in terms of actually the little vignettes, it's primarily visual storytelling. There's not much in each scene in terms of language and interaction between characters. It's just the way the camera is positioned and the way that these characters are positioned within the frame tells you everything that you need to know about who these people are, what their interactions are, how they feel about each other. It's beautiful filmmaking.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're talking about... are you talking about the idea that the film is trying to push this idea of there's a wonderful beauty that comes from the connection between people?
Yeah.
And everyone's sharing... I mean, let's take, for example... this is another thing that Ghibli does really well, is there's a lot of usually kind of industrial workshops around, or a lot of movement and fire and, you know...
Yep.
All that sort of thing. And in this film, there's the glassmaker's workshop, and you have the glassmaster who's like kind of this, like, rambunctious...
He does not want
passionate man.
He does not want boobs on his jars, God.
Yeah, and so a lot of the fellas are making the glass jars with the boobs on them. And later on in the film, you find that the uncle who's looking after Ingmar has bought. Well, I don't know what he's bought. He's managed to grab one of these that the glass master was smashing. And there's not much. The film doesn't really care to make it a strong point that he took one.
No, not at all.
It's just kind of they're using it, and it's a nice, soft little gag almost.
But and that's towards the real tail end of the film, but that's almost used as an instance of hammering home a point of how much of a free spirit and nice guy that this character is. Like, the uncle and the aunt, like, throughout the film, they're just presented as the most wonderful, lovely people for Ingmar to go and essentially live with after, spoiler alert, his mother ends up passing away. And it's never explicitly told in any sense of... At no point does the uncle sit down and say to Ingmar, like, look, I know you're going through a tough time, I'm there for you, like, you know, I lost my sister as well, but, like, I'm here for you, buddy. It's never explicitly said. It's just said in this non-verbal language of the way that these characters interact with each other. Like,
that's right. Yeah. I mean, just sharing a laugh between the fact that they got a milk jug filled with tits on them.
Yeah.
And they're both just enjoying this lovely little moment together.
Or it's the moment, like, I'm jumping to is when Ingmar moves back finally to the town after his mother has passed away. And he brings up the notion, he brings up death with the old man who lived downstairs having passed away. He's like, oh, how did he die? And he's like, oh, he was just old. Hey, do you want to listen to the record? It's just this nice little thing of... It's the two of them having an understanding of this is something that happens in life, but we don't need to dwell, like, you know, let it overcome us, so let's listen to the funny record and annoy your aunt again. Like,
yeah, it's really...
It's beautiful. Really,
and there's... I mean, we could go on and on and on about these kinds of little moments that crop up. In fact, I made a list. I mean, you're just talking about the old fellow.
Mr. Arvidsson.
Mr. Arvidsson that's sickly, being old downstairs. And he's sharing a moment with Ingmar when he gets little Ingmar to read aloud this lingerie catalogue.
Which is, like, in and of itself, like, the funniest idea. It's an old man who's dying who can't, like, read himself, so he gets a little kid to read the lingerie catalogue.
And then he hides it when the knocking on the door comes and someone's...
It's so beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, there's lovely, like, cheekiness to everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's just playing around, but at the same time, there's this undertone of sadness and tragedy.
Do you think that the predominance of kind of playfulness and cheekiness being like that kind of top layer with the sadness kind of seeping in below, that being a thing because the film is presented through the eyes of a 12-year-old kid going, like, that's what we're going on his journey, Ingmar's journey.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the film so perfectly presents it in that way. Do you think that's the case?
Oh, yeah. Extrapolate.
Oh, it's... I think I'm done. It's more that thing of, yeah, because we're viewing the film... Like, a 12-year-old kid isn't necessarily going through life being like, oh, God, the weight of what has to come... And, like, you know, having social anxieties and all of those kind of things that are, like...
Sure.
Weights on his shoulders. He's just... We're presented the weird and wonderful, magical little moments of his life at that point.
Take, for instance... and we'll say spoilers. If you haven't watched this film, I really think you should.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you like those lovely, beautiful Ghibli moments.
I would say another one similar is Amarcord by Fellini. This is very similar to that.
So at this point, if you like that kind of stuff, you should definitely stop listening and go and watch the film. But coming back to your point, they don't show the death of Ingmar's mum.
Yeah.
They just skip it.
What happens is he's out with his friend and gets his mother a toaster for Christmas.
Yeah. So you get this taste of these pretty serious adult themes.
Yeah.
And they're always strongly implied. And you know that Ingmar's kind of thinking about it. Because obviously, like, one of the major points of the film... Well, major aspects of the film is him constantly revisiting and narrating about strange and bizarre ways people die.
Mm.
There's, like, the stuntman that tries to jump the 31 buses.
Yep.
And if you'd only... Maybe if you'd only put 30 buses, he might have survived.
Yeah.
Then there's... what else I put...
The big ones. Leica.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to come to that one. That's the biggest one.
That's the biggest. We'll get to that later.
I really like the idea that him talking about finding a story about a man that's crossing, like, an athletics sports field.
Yeah, and gets the javelin.
And the javelin goes through the guy's chest. Yeah. So it's like... sucks.
And it's even...
But there's a funny aspect to it, too. I mean, like...
Yeah. And we even get instances of it within the film that he experiences, like the guy riding the unicycle on the tightrope. Who falls and everyone thinks he might have died, but, like, no, he didn't. And then Ingmar himself falling through the glass window, like, skylight on, like, he...
Yeah, yeah.
Because he wanted to look at boobs.
It's pretty funny. Each time Ingmar, as the narrator, brings up these bizarre deaths,
mm-hmm.
I kind of find myself chuckling slightly.
Yeah.
And I think it's because it's so tragic and unlucky,
yeah.
A lot of these things. I mean, the guy getting a javelin in his chest, so fucking unlucky, that it's kind of funny.
Yeah, and it's great that Ingmar, as a protagonist, is kind of viewing his life or examining the idea of death, which is something that's very prevalent in his life, through these weird, unlucky circumstances, in that the first time he's introduced to his aunt and uncle in the moving, he's presented as an incredibly lucky person. That's mm-hmm. how she introduces him to her life, his aunt, I guess. It says, you've brought the nice weather with you, you're a lucky person because of that.
Yeah.
And the rest of the film, he's narrating these bizarre instances of luck leading to death.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then there's Leica, which is... stylistically... The scenes are always truncated, or they intercut with this lovely starscape.
Yeah, that's very much keeping with the vignette kind of idea, which I have to feel, because this is based off of a novel, that might be their kind of way to bridge the time gaps as well that happen in this novel.
Yeah. But it gives you time to reflect on... I mean, because he brings up Leica... Does everybody know about Leica?
Do you want to give a quick synopsis of who Leica is?
Well, Ingmar mentions that he finds it interesting that this dog went to space.
Yeah, Leica was the first dog. She was the dog put in Sputnik and sent to space. But then she starved in the vessel. Yeah.
And that, you know,
it's... And they knew she was never coming back. And that it's the idea, you know, you can use it to examine the futility of life and the inevitability of death. And...
But I think why he's so connected to Leica the dog is because she was sent off to die
mm-hmm.
for the good of everybody else.
Yeah.
And he kind of connects with that because he's being sent off for the good of his mum.
Yeah, that's true. That's a nice one.
So what was I saying about Leica?
Well, that like brings us to... Like,
oh, yeah. There we go. So that's why I think another aspect of this kind of starscape thing is you constantly just are reminded of this dog that was sent out there to starve to death.
Yeah.
Because humans were like, we gotta do it, man. We gotta do it.
But I think that, like, it works twofold in the sense of, like, how you've explained that, you know, he sympathizes with Leica as being a creature that was sent away for the good, for a greater good. But it's also the idea, I kind of view the film, and like the title of the film, My Life as a Dog, it's an interesting title that's never really explained or necessarily...
Well, I think it's, talking about the title, I think I think it's a fucking fantastic title.
Yes.
Because as soon as they mentioned Laika the dog,
yes,
you all of a sudden are thinking about this is very important. I need to pay attention to Laika.
Mm-hmm.
Without the title, My Life as a Dog. I mean, he acts like a dog as well, but...
No,
But that's all part and parcel with this connection to Laika.
But it's also... I kind of view it in this idea that he's this kind of creature that's just ended up being kind of pushed out there and is just kind of floating through space, and these things are happening and occurring to him, and he's just presenting them as they come and happen. As they present themselves, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, he's never... Can you name an instance where he's really reacting to something and driving the plot? I mean, think of Saga, who's this young girl that he befriends while he's with his uncle. And she's a bit of a tomboy and probably better at all the sports, including boxing and soccer, than all the other fellas.
Yeah, well, she's pretending to be a boy to play on the soccer team
here. Yeah, yeah. But she kind of falls for him, I suppose.
Yeah, oh, 100%. Yeah, yeah.
And even when he's pushed by her to even touch her boobies.
Yeah.
He reacts, but it's not in a way that it's... that
a positive pushing... force driving the narrative forward in that sense. Yeah, yeah.
Or even driving her as a character forward. She's...
Yeah.
She's kind of... She kind of rebounds away.
And it just drags this thing out as a weird, twisted love triangle that ends up kind of exploding at the party and then a boxing match where it gets punched off of a balcony in the barn. Like, it's...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All of these weird things. Like, yeah, he is a passive participant in his own life, which is, I guess, again, drawing back to Laika, just this thing that was shot out there and is experiencing these things as a passive observer, just kind of being hurtled towards them. Like, even the sense of when he's Brigitte, is that the girl's name? The really hot lady who works at the glassmakers who's posing for a nude sculpture. She, like, he doesn't instigate, like, the idea of, like, oh, you're going along for this, can I come too? Like, she drags him to it, and he kind of seems bored by it, and...
Well...
And until his uncle starts pressing him for information about it, being like, hey, this is something cool you get to be a part of. You get
How naked was she? Was she really naked?
Yeah. Cool is like in air quotes, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, for a 12-year-old boy, that's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, yeah. He falls through a skylight to see some boobies, but... Yeah, he is just this... I wouldn't go so far as to say unwilling participant, but he is just a kind of passive participant that's hurtling through all of these events.
I agree with you. It doesn't give me a massive sense... Like, he has some kind of agency, too. Like, he's...
Agency in the sense of that he's aware of his own existence and mortality, I feel.
Mm.
Similar to... Like, that's my idea, that he's extrapolating the idea of... My life as a dog. He, like Laika, is just being hurtled through all of these interesting experiences, and he will take them as they come.
I'm just trying to get to... we've already kind of gone pretty far into it, into the film, but I do want to try and see if we can get to the bottom of it.
Okay, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
I was wondering about that while we were watching it, if... Because knowing that we would end up having this conversation, do you think there is a be-all, end-all, finite point to the film? Like, is there a giant message this film is trying to present, or is it...
See, I don't know. I'm not sure. That's what I'm...
Or does it fall into that Armacord kind of camp of just examining a weird and wonderful comedic life, and it's you as an individual viewing it, you take from these experiences that this character goes through what you take from them?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
No, because I don't know.
No.
Because as you're watching the film, it's so beautiful at times because it's not taking the tragedy of life all that serious.
Yeah.
But then... underneath, you have a sense that it is very serious. And then sometimes you have moments where, say, like, towards the end, Ingmar's crying and he's very worried that he killed his mum.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's pretty brutal. And these situations where or the sequence where he finds out that his dog had died and had been dead for a while.
Yeah.
So it's not just from moment to moment isn't life grand and wonderful and beautiful.
No.
So, but at the same time, it's because, I guess because Ingmar's a passive observer. I'm not sure if he is. That's the thing.
He's not a passive observer. He's a passive vessel, I guess might be the word, or passive protagonist. Like, he is our drive through this narrative. Like, we're going on this journey with him, but he is an individual because he's an alienated person in this new surroundings. He's very passive as a character, so therefore we as a viewer take a passive step back with him, I guess.
I'm gonna try and answer your question this way.
Mm-hmm.
Some films, they don't reveal the point of the film until the very last shot.
Yep.
Think of Billboards. What is it called? Three Billboards in Missouri?
Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Yeah.
Yep.
You don't really get to the point of the film until the very last shot where the two are driving.
Yeah.
I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, we won't spoil that. That's fairly recent.
If you've seen that, you know that the point of it is revealed in a single piece of dialogue.
Yep. Yes.
And likewise in this film, if we focus on the last shot, there is this fellow hammering constantly throughout the film. If you don't see him, sometimes you hear him in the background.
Yeah.
And he's just constantly just tapping away.
Yeah.
Fixing holes in his house through summer and bloody, like, all through the year, winter. And the last shot of the film is him back on, like, it's got the whole film has gone through summer to winter, and it's back to summer again.
Yeah.
And the credits roll, and it's just this fella kind of hammering on a house.
Yep.
Looking after a place that he lives in and probably cares for people in.
Yep.
So I got a strong sense, a strong urge to say that there's a lot to that character.
Yeah.
Who's always in the background somewhere throughout the whole film.
Persistence?
Yeah, just...
Or just going about just doing what needs to be done, I guess, regardless of what life throws at you, whether it be you need to fix your roof, but it's fucking winter, but you just got to do it anyway, which is essentially, I guess, what Ingmar is doing. He's, like, had a rough hand dealt to him, yet he's just doing the best he can as a kid, kind of going through it.
Patching the holes. I mean, the mum...
That's a great way to look at it, patching the holes.
The mum was patching the holes because she was sick.
Yeah.
And she does love her children heaps, right? Oh,
loves them dearly. Yeah. Which is what makes the death so upsetting.
And we haven't even mentioned Ingmar's father.
Yes.
Who is working overseas loading bananas.
He's a sailor loading bananas on shipping containers in South America.
So the film only touches on him briefly. And yes. It's pretty much just finishes with the idea that he has to because no one else will, and that's just the way that he can get cash.
My sense is that's because we're being presented the narrative through the eyes of a kid, and if you were a little kid and you were told that's what your dad was doing, you'd just be like, yeah, well, okay, cool. You just accept that narrative, and so that's the narrative we're being presented.
I don't know if that banana story is true.
No, but at that point, it doesn't matter if it's true or not.
Yeah.
That's what Ingmar believes is happening, and that's all we get of it, and that's fun.
That's a very fantastical...
Yes.
Story.
Yes.
So, who knows really what the dad's doing, but the mum was doing her best. The guy fixing the holes in his house is doing the best. The uncle's doing his best because he gets a strong sense that he needs to fucking look after Ingmar.
Yeah, And he and his wife, Ulla, are wonderful people as well.
Yeah, yeah,
they're really nice. And I think Ingmar himself, like as a little kid, is trying to make the best of the situations that are thrown to him, of having his life completely upheaved, and he's had to move to this new town and live with people like he doesn't really know. And...
Well, while you were watching, you mentioned that it kind of was amazing that he...
The adaptability of kids.
That's right, yeah. So he's constantly... I mean, he's not always 100% happy all the time, but he's happy a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Even though he's been... move from here to here to blah, 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 to there.
He's adaptable. He's able to make friends wherever he goes because he's a little 12-year-old kid, and that's what 12-year-old kids do. They're like, all right, well, I guess I'm here now. what's up?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the film is terribly optimistic.
Yes.
And
which makes it a beautiful film to watch, because you're being flung all of these pessimistic ideas and, you know, inevitabilities of life, but they're being presented through the optimism of a 12-year-old kid.
But not only that, you have the optimism of the uncle and the man hammering.
Yeah.
I love the guy hammering.
You love it. Okay? Yeah.
I really love it. There's a sequence where Ingmar's talking to his mum.
Yeah, because he eventually...
On a payphone. Yeah. And in the background, you can just hear the hammering. You know, like, you don't see him in that whole scene, but he's just here.
Yeah. It's not to mention, he goes swimming in an ice lake at the end. Yeah.
This film is just fucking marvellous.
Yeah. You know what? I couldn't help but make the, like... I wanted to push aside the similarities between Armacord, because that, you know, we've already discussed that film way back when. But in terms of another kind of 12-year-old kid...
Fourth episode,
yeah. Mm. It jumped up to me the notions of, like, other 12-year-old kind of... Films with 12-year-old kids as protagonists going through some stuff. I was like, it's... Stand By Me is another film, I think, in term... vaguely similar to this, that has a somewhat optimistic take on childhood, like a little kid protagonist going through, but it's not presented in a optimistic light, unfortunately.
Yeah, that film feels like a struggle.
It does, right? That's like, yeah. It's a wonderful film, but the way that it presents, it's not presented through the eyes of a 12-year-old kid, it's presented through the eyes of a 45-year-old looking back on his 12-year-old life.
Yes, yeah.
And so you're presented constantly the narration done by Richard Dreyfuss of, like, this nagging idea of, you know, adulthood and death and self-awareness of what you were going through at the time, whereas this film just presents through the eyes of a 12-year-old kid, and it makes it so much more lovely.
Yeah, it does.
Imagine this film if it had Richard Dreyfuss narrating it, like, there I was on a train. I love Richard Dreyfuss, but, like, no.
Yeah, this film's really remarkable, man.
Yeah. Was there anything else in your notes that we didn't hit?
We've covered all my notes at this point.
Was there anything else you wanted to... I think we've really, like, it's a film... Because there's not much of an actual narrative drive to it. It is just these vignette things that we can't... At this point, we'd just be talking about our favourite moments.
Mm.
I mean, actually, we should talk about the direction, actually, and the cinematography, I think. Because both of those were impeccable, I think. It's a lot of subtle camera movement. I mean, obviously, we've discussed throughout this whole episode how it's a very visual film. And that, you know, the camera is explaining what these characters are in their using their words. In addition to that, there's some wonderful one-shots where the camera will kind of sweep through scenes and kind of interact with characters, like through the classroom or through the glassworks factory.
But there's also shots that you can return to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of... I love it when filmmakers do this.
Mm-hmm.
Remember there's the... there's Ingmar and Saga, the girlfriend, I suppose, who jump into that still-framed... rocket ship on a zip line.
Yeah, the UFO, yeah.
And during the summertime, they jump in and it slides down and it kind of stops and there's some kind of jam. And then they come back to the same shot but in wintertime and the zip line works again.
It's still there and it's covered in snow and it hasn't changed.
And it hasn't moved, they haven't fixed it. And then in the summertime, they come back to the exact same shot and it does work.
Well, could that be a giant... Like, can we extrapolate that that's... You know, Ingmar, a representation of Ingmar as a character growing and being able to... He's been stuck at this one point and now being able to move forward.
Yeah, that's not bad. That's not bad.
Having accepted
who could prove
his
you
new
wrong.
Life. Yeah.
No, that's I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. But I just really enjoy... I mean, if this film is trying to provide a comfort and optimism, then... It only makes sense that you keep returning to the same kinds of shots so that you learn the town and the environment that Ingmar's in. And, you know, naturally you're going to feel confident in that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the what'd you call it, cinematography or like...
Yeah, and the direction, I think, as well.
Yeah. It's fucking amazing.
It's pretty fantastic. The music as well is very lovely. There's nothing somber about it, despite the fact that there's a lot of somber things that happen throughout the film. It's always...
There's one sequence. I mean, most of the time it's this plucky piano stuff, which is really beautiful and heartwarming. But then there is one sequence where Ingmar is having, I guess you would call, a breakdown, where he's really... I guess he's missing his mum. And the soundtrack, there's piano, but it is so muted that you can hardly hear it, and everything's slow motion. Do you remember this sequence?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the only time when the music is not this wonderful, plucky thing.
Yeah.
That sequence is impeccable, by the way.
I found it interesting doing a little bit of research about this film. The constant that seems to keep popping up with this film is that it destroys people. Like, apparently everybody cries with this movie.
I had a teary.
Yeah, I had like the single kind of...
I had a couple of moments where thing. It was... The tears were just... They weren't, you know, gushing, but they're...
But, like, even to the point of, like, the... Back when they... This is one where Criterion used to do this amazing thing called the Three Reasons videos.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was, like, the three reasons you should watch a movie. And the third reason for My Life as a Dog is... Because you'll need an extra box of tissues. And I cry at the drop of a hat. I will fucking cry at anything. And this film, I only got, like, the single tear kind of rolling. It didn't get me as hard as... I expected it to, based on the research and, like, kind of knowing that everyone loses it at this film. I don't know if that was because I had guard up because of that, or...
I think you were unlucky. Mm. Because I'm pretty sure, nearly 100% sure, that if you watched this sometime later...
Yeah, just on my own, on without having the pretense of the podcast and everything.
It'll hit you. Because...
Where did it hit for you?
There was kind of multiple times,
mm-hmm.
When that, there was that kind of, that muted sequence I was just explaining earlier, where it's like slow motion and Ingmar's kind of, grappling, cuddling his dog underneath his mum's bed.
Yeah.
What else?
Kind of, that's the moment where he has the realization that both of them have...
Gone. There was a couple other sequences I forget now, but it just kind of cropped up. Like, I was surprised.
Yeah,
I gotta admit, I was surprised that I was getting affected in these really weird ways. I suppose I wouldn't normally get affected. Maybe I would.
Mm. It's not necessarily a super sad cry either. It's a kind
no.
Of,
there's
it's
a wonderful general. Yeah, that's why this movie's so good, because I'm not crying because it's sad, I cry because it's bittersweet.
Yeah, you're being presented this beauty of life, and...
Yeah, like, it's all part and parcel, and it's just, it kind of displays just, like, a wonderful collection of stuff that life is. The good with the bad, and yeah, it's affecting.
It's great. This movie is fucking fantastic.
Didn't you say that there was, like, a whole bunch of people... that do their top 10 Criterion films, and this is always in them.
Yeah, the top 10 thing on Criterion. I was obviously having a look through, and I had a bit of a read of the essay and things that goes along with the Criterion edition. And looking on the website, there's a lot, like, there's an inordinate amount of, like, people that have this in their, like, my top 10 of Criterion. So... And rewatching it, I'm like, yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah.
I cannot fault this film. I was thinking while watching it, like, man, this is going to be an easy, like, look back when we get to the previous
two. We've had a good run, man.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've had a run as solid as this one. So, I don't know. On that note, do you want to hear the little bit of trivia I have about this one?
Sure.
So the film was nominated for 2 Academy Awards at the 1988 Oscars. I was nominated for Best Director for Lasse Hallström. And it was also nominated for Best Screenplay, Adapted. I unfortunately didn't win either of them. However, it did win the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film. It was also nominated for the BAFTA for Best Foreign Language Film. It was also nominated for the Directors Guild of America Best Director Award, Independent Spirit Award for Best Foreign Language Film, which it won. Yeah, a ridiculous amount of awards. And it was listed by the National Board of Review as one of the top 10 films of the year. So it's was incredibly praised and lauded when it finally came out in the US in 1988. The only other two things that I had, trivia-wise, were that this was Richard Harris's favourite film. So you would know him as, you brought up Unforgiven earlier in the episode. He's mm-hmm. Bob the Englishman.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first Dumbledore.
Oh, rip.
This was his favourite film. And the other one I found interesting was, this is one of the author Kurt Vonnegut's favourite films, tied with All About Eve and Casablanca.
Kurt Vonnegut?
Yeah.
I've read a whole bunch of his shit.
You're looking at your bookshelf, but all that's up there, we're in the video game room, so no, there are no novels. Oh, wait, no, you do have a Vonnegut up there?
What's this one? No. It's Frederick Pohl. No, I do have a whole bunch of his shit, and he's fucking awesome.
He's fantastic. So, yeah, this was one of his favourite films with Casablanca and All About Eve.
Yeah, this is a crowd favourite.
Yeah, but it's a bit unfortunate. I couldn't find any real information about the production or, you know, any other little tidbits. This is a kind of under-the-radar one, I guess.
That's fine with me. Mm. I don't mind. Like this.
You want the mysticism of the story.
Yeah, I kind
of
do, yeah.
You want Ingmar to be a real kid somewhere who was grown up.
Yeah, I wanted a kind of a Narnia, you know.
Well, there was a somewhat planned sequel, because this was based off of a novel. The guy who wrote the book and the producers who made this film wanted to make a sequel film based off the success of this one called My Life as a Dog at Sea. And it was all about Ingmar boarding a cruise ship, like traveling the Mediterranean and South America in search of his father.
Well, I would like Ghibli to take that on.
I'm fine with that not existing and this just being this own standalone thing. I don't think this needed to be sequelized.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But I would have loved to see. Like, how much would it have fitted if you have a kind of Ghibli sequence where the dog goes into space? Can you just imagine this kind of stuff?
Like, actually cutting to Laika flying up and things.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Or it'd be interesting.
You could just imagine that steel-framed rocket ship on a zipline cutting back through from shot to shot in his Ghibli film.
God damn, I hadn't even made the connection with the flying saucer zipline they're on and the constant tying back to Laika. Good lord.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's rich.
It's all connected.
You could study this film at school, fucking no worries.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were discussing during this that What's Eating Gilbert Grape, the other Lasse Hallström film, is actually studied in Australian kind of high school curriculum. Neither of us or Colleen studied it, but
some people did.
Some people, some lucky people did. Yeah, but you know, you're totally right. This film, this would be a rich, rich film to study in high school, I think.
Yeah. Or any school.
At any point, really. I mean, fuck, what have we spent the last 40 minutes doing? On that note, should we move on to the Criterion edition?
Mm.
So the film is still in print from Criterion as a one-disc DVD or a one-disc Blu-ray, and it comes with the following special features of Shall We Go to Your or My Place or Each Go Home Alone, a 1973 52-minute film by Lasse Hallström with video introduction by the director. New video interview with Lasse Hallström.
Is that one of his first ones?
Yeah, from 1973. It's one of his first films, yeah.
Okay.
Interview with Hallström, a theatrical trailer, and usual booklet and essays the Criterion usually do, including an appreciation by author Kurt Vonnegut.
Nice.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Just bear with me. I want to figure out remind myself what Kurt had written.
No, that's Bradbury that did Fahrenheit 451. Slaughterhouse 5 is Vonnegut.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What have I fucking read? The Sirens of Titan. Yes!
Okay.
That shit is awesome.
I've only read Slaughterhouse 5.
Okay, so yeah, I've read The Sirens of Titan. It's fucking awesome. Anyway. Well,
Yeah. On that note, I guess that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode, looking at Lasse Hallström's My Life as a Dog. If you have not seen this film, please do yourself a favor and go and watch it. It's amazing. Other than that, we'll be back in a fortnight's time when we have a box set. First one in quite a while. We're watching the I Am Curious box.
I'm very excited about this one.
I Am Curious, Yellow and Blue. Pseudo semi-fictional documentaries examining sexual exploration. I said that really weird. I really did. Sexual exploration.
Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm fucking very excited to, yes, to watch this one. This will be fascinating.
Yeah. So tune in for that. Otherwise, you can send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at Criterion Quest or through Facebook at The Criterion Quest. Please let us know your thoughts, feelings about My Life as a Dog. We'd love to hear them. Other than that, we'll see you in a fortnight's time. For this week's episode, I'm Chris.
And I'm Tom. See you next time.